This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, April 25th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll dig into some of the lesser-known histories of labor struggles in Colorado's coal fields with a local author. Replacing lead pipes with PVC? A new report says that's leaping from the frying pan into the fire. That story and more on This Week in Water. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then, it's How on Earth. This week, the science show visits with the Sea Detective to uncover the origin stories behind many of our everyday food heroes. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Volleyball Paul will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for the headlines. With KGNU's John Kellen.
City officials in Boulder are hailing a U.S. Supreme Court decision to allow lawsuits brought by municipalities in five states, including Colorado, to move forward in state courts. The High Court yesterday rejected a request by ExxonMobil and Suncor that it review an appeals court ruling that the case belonged at the state court level. A ruling in the oil company's favor would have forced the city of Boulder, Boulder County, and San Miguel County, among others, into federal court. Instead, the municipalities can proceed in state court with their efforts to hold the corporations accountable for the effects of climate change. Boulder Mayor Aaron Brockett said the Supreme Court ruling affirmed what the city already knew, that their case deserves its day in local court. He added that it's local communities that experience the impact and cost of climate change. The president of the Center for Climate Integrity told NBC News that big oil companies wanted to avoid state courts because plaintiffs have a better chance of winning. A ruling on whether to block Colorado's new law that bans so-called medication abortion reversals could come by the end of this week. KGNU's Alyssa Palazzo reports.
A federal judge yesterday heard arguments from state officials and from the CEO of a faith-based clinic challenging the new law. Colorado officials have already pledged not to enforce the state's new ban on medication abortion reversal until after regulatory boards issue rules about it. That's expected to happen sometime this fall. But the CEO of Bella Health and Wellness Clinic in Inglewood said she wants more than just a promise from the state. The clinic's attorneys are asking the judge to block the law entirely until legal challenges are played out. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has already said that the medication abortion reversal treatments are not based in science. Governor Jared Polis signed the bill banning them earlier this month. Bella Health and Wellness applied for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction soon after. The judge's ruling on the matter is expected by this Saturday. For KGNU, I'm Alyssa Palazzo.
CU Boulder campus police are looking for two suspects involved in an attempted armed robbery early this morning at the University of Colorado's William Village dorms. CU police sent the initial alert warning of gunfire through the campus alert system at around 4 a.m. Just before sunrise, they announced that the two suspects had fled the scene in a white Jeep Cherokee. A competency hearing is scheduled for late next month for the man accused in the mass murder at a Boulder King Supers 2 years ago. A judge ruled in late 2021 that the suspect was not competent to stand trial based on evaluations at a mental health hospital in Pueblo. Prosecutors challenged that ruling, calling the diagnosis flawed. Psychological experts for the defense, however, stand by their evaluation. The suspect faces more than 100 criminal charges stemming from the March 2021 mass shooting that killed 10 people. The hearing is scheduled to last for 3 days and begins on May 23rd. Two more people are reporting that their vehicles were damaged by someone throwing rocks at them in Jefferson County last week. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
That brings the total number of reports of rocks thrown at cars last week to 7. Nine News reports one of those incidents resulted in the death of a 20-year-old Arvada woman. Alexa Bartell was killed as she drove home from work. All 7 incidents happened between 10:15 last Wednesday night and shortly after midnight Thursday morning. Neither driver in the 2 new reports was hurt, although the windshields of each vehicle were damaged. Both happened as they drove on southbound Colorado 93. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Department is saying that the rocks were 3 to 5 pounds, possibly landscaping rocks. The sheriff's office is asking residents near the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge to check any home surveillance footage on April 19th between 9:45 and 11 p.m. to see if a light-colored pickup truck or SUV can be seen. A sheriff's office spokesman said they have received nearly 300 tips since Thursday. No arrests have been made. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
Colorado Attorney Phil Weiser will hold a meeting in Longmont today to gather community feedback on the proposed merger between grocery store giants Albertsons and Kroger. The two companies operate the Safeway and King Soopers chains in Colorado. The meeting takes place this afternoon from 4 to 5 p.m. at Longmont High School. Boulder Fire Rescue will become the first fire department in Colorado to have an electric fire engine. The city announced yesterday that it will receive the state-of-the-art fire engine late next year or in early 2025. In addition to reduced emissions, the Rosenbauer RTX has features that better support firefighters, as well as all-wheel drive, all-wheel steering, and less operational noise. The electric fire engine has a $1.78 million price tag. City officials say it's a planned expense and that it's part of a broader movement toward electric vehicles. Finally, this morning, KGNU is pleased to announce the purchase of what will become its new home on 14th Street in the heart of downtown Boulder. The building acquisition comes as KGNU celebrates 45 years of operations as Boulder's community radio station. The building purchase was made possible in part by a November 2017 ballot measure to invest sales tax dollars into local nonprofits. KGNU received access to a $1.25 million grant from the city of Boulder, with a stipulation that the station match that amount through fundraising. KGNU plans to remodel the new location into state-of-the-art broadcast and production studios, including a live music performance space. The station expects to move into its new home at 1720 14th Street in early 2025. In today's weather outlook, a rainy day is expected along the Front Range with a chance of heavy rain and thunderstorms after 4 p.m. Expect a high of 60 degrees in Denver, 53 degrees in Boulder, 54 degrees in Fort Collins. Up in Nederland, look for a high of 41 degrees with a winter storm warning in effect after noon. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. How much did the labor battles of Colorado coal workers contribute to the legal gains of the New Deal era? Perhaps more than you think. A new book out from University of Colorado Press details how a labor movement, literally in Boulder County's backyard, provided much of the social context leading up to the major progressive gains of the 1930s. Joining me in the studio is Lee Campbell Hale, author of the new book, Remembering Ludlow But Forgetting the Columbine. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So what is this Columbine that you refer to in the title of your book?
Well, most people, when they hear Columbine Massacre, because, you know, last week you would see Facebook posts from Columbine High School when the two boys came in and killed their classmates and the teachers. So most people think, well, that's the Columbine Massacre. But the first Columbine Massacre was November 21st, 1927, right pretty much at County Line Road. There was a massive statewide strike going on, and the Prohibition police, most of them Ku Klux Klan members, had recently been put into service as strike police. And there were daily protests at the Columbine Mine because it was one of the few coal mines in the state that was trying to stay open. It was run by the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company. It was a company town, ironically, I guess, called Serene, not so serene. And about 500 protesters marched on this company town, and these state police fired into the crowd, killing six, probably wounding 60, and that became known as the Columbine Massacre, especially to the workers at that time. So it was the turning point of the strike, but, you know.
But this came after years and years of labor struggles around coal mines. So, for example, Ludlow,
right.
You say Ludlow is much more better known, but not necessarily in the vernacular of everybody. Well,
right. So, you know, Ludlow, if you're a labor history person, you know what it is. And a lot of people who know about Colorado history know about Ludlow. And Ludlow usually gets a nod in most textbooks. It's mentioned. It's famous because on April 20th, 1914, the Ludlow Massacre, what became to be called the Ludlow Massacre, took place, and that was in the midst of another coal strike, this one from 1910 to 1914. And the most violent phase of that strike, from 1913 to 1914, unfolded in Colorado's southern coal fields, down around, you know, Trinidad. And when those miners joined the strike, they were kicked out of their company housing. And so the miners, the United Mine Workers, which was the organization, you know, sponsoring the strike, set up tent colonies. So families moved to these tent colonies, and they were fired into. The tents caught on fire, and 11 children and two women were found dead, and that became known as the Ludlow Massacre. It was a very violent strike. At least one historian's estimate at least 75 people died, so it may be the deadliest labor conflict in American history. So people have probably heard the word Ludlow. You know, Woody Guthrie wrote a song about it, and then Howard Zinn was working on the docks, and he heard the song, and he said, wait a minute, how come I've never heard about Ludlow? And so that really, he credits that as this foundational moment when he started asking the question, how come I don't know so much about so much American history? And that really started his whole investigation that led to People's History of the United States. So that's why most people came to hear about Ludlow. And in fact, when George McGovern was running for president against Richard Nixon in 1972, he polished off his 1950s PhD dissertation about that 13 to 14 violent phase of the strike, and wrote a book about it. And it became, you know, well known. But at that point, it didn't really resonate with the labor movement like he hoped it would. But it did resonate with young people who were getting fired on by the National Guard. So it became sort of a countercultural moment.
So we're talking about these little known histories. You spent much of your professional career as a history teacher. How are these stories covered in textbooks?
Well, yeah, that's the point. You know, when you teach U.S. history, you, for as long as I did, you start to sort of memorize these textbooks. And there's this narrative. I call it our national origin myth, right? And although these histories change a little bit over time, the structures of the chapters don't really change at all. And boy, do I have that narrative memorized. And so, you know, Ludlow usually gets dropped into the progressives chapter, and it'll mention the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire Factory. You know, for example, where 115 women jumped out of the windows of Manhattan because their factory was on fire. And then Ludlow, you know, will be mentioned because it was so violent. And then it's like, but the progressives, they were outraged. You know, so they came along and they were horrified by the excesses from the top corporate people, and they thought workers should be treated better. So they wanted to come together and, you know, fix these problems. So Ludlow gets like a sentence or two, which isn't a lot, but I mean, it's more than what you hear about from labor conflicts in the 20s, which is zero. You know, because if you look at the 1920s chapters, you know, you get the Charleston, you get the Republican presidents, you get mass culture and stuff. And the word I kept coming across when it had to do with workers in the 1920s was quiescent. The workers were quiescent, you know? And so my question was like, well, if they were so quiescent, how did they rise up in the 1930s? This doesn't make sense to me. And so that's really what got me interested. That and the fact that the strike in Colorado in 27-28 was led by the industrial workers of the world, which every textbook says dies out at, you know, during the World War I era. And I'm like, if they were dead, how did they lead a statewide strike? Maybe they weren't so dead, you know?
Well, there's lots of fascinating history here. We have very little time. Mm-hmm. You will be at the Boulder Bookstore tonight. Tell folks about what they can expect.
Well, it starts at 6:30. I hope it's fun. I've invited everybody I've ever known, so I'll see if they show up or not. Boulder Bookstore said I can talk for 30 minutes and that's it. And so for a former teacher, that's terrible because I can talk for 30 hours without probably taking a breath. But I will try to cover the highlights of the book, the organization of the book. I won't do a lot of reading because, frankly, I'm not a very good reader when it comes to that kind of stuff. So I'll just talk about the book and then take lots of questions from people who I hope have some. You know?
Well, my last question for you is, what can the history of Columbine and Ludlow teach labor movements of today?
My big picture, you know, is that nobody gave organized labor anything. Nobody gave workers anything. So a lot of the textbooks that I taught from portrayed FDR and, you know, leader of the United Mine Workers, John L. Lewis, as these, it was sort of this great men, great deeds form of history. Oh, isn't it wonderful that they gave workers the right to organize, and didn't that change everything? And aren't these labor laws that got written in the 1930s awesome? Well, you know, not so much. Those laws were written because people were scared to death of these militant workers. And it's always militant workers who drive the labor movement. And we're starting to see inklings of that today where workers rise up. So, you know, don't depend. The idea is that it's the workers that drive change, not politicians.
Lee Campbell Hale, author of the new book, Remembering Ludlow But Forgetting the Columbine. Thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me.
And you can catch her at the Boulder Bookstore later tonight at 6:30. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. We'll be right back on the other side of this break. Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
How Crusta Voltaics Could Restore Arid Lands. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
As many communities across the country remove lead water lines after the Flint, Michigan crisis, there's concern they may be leaping from the frying pan into the fire if they replace those pipes with ones made from polyvinyl chloride, or PVC.
The nonprofit organization Beyond Plastics reported last week that PVC poses a risk to human health, identifying dozens of dangerous chemicals leaching from the pipes, like benzene, styrene, and other volatile organic compounds.
PVC can also release hormone disruptors, which can cause health problems, particularly in children and developing fetuses. According to the authors, it is difficult to be certain about the exact number of chemicals released by the pipes because manufacturers use different formulas.
The government has not researched PVC pipe safety and doesn't require manufacturers to provide information to the public about chemical releases.
The potential harm to humans from exposure to these chemicals is not well understood. However, Bruce Blumberg of the University of California, Irvine, told Beyond Plastics that PVC is a horror show.
Beyond Plastics recommends that more data are urgently needed to show the potential toxic consequences of using PVC pipes, and in the meantime, copper or stainless steel should be considered.
You've probably heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, made up of plastics and other debris collecting between California and Hawaii.
That patch is not like a solid island, and you can't even see it on satellite images. Rather, it's more like a cloudy soup of plastic and debris that circulates in a gyre or vortex about twice the size of Texas.
It's dotted with things like shoes and fishing gear, and extends from the surface to the ocean floor. And those pieces of plastic, they're teeming with life one wouldn't expect to see in the open ocean.
Scientists at the University of Hawaii Manoa have shown that the creatures such as worms, anemones, mollusks, and crabs, which previously survived only in coastal communities, are now colonizing on the garbage patch.
The majority of the trash that washes up on the Hawaiian Islands is from the plastic vortex, which could lead to an invasion of non-native species. Before the plastic conveyor, species could reach new locales by hitchhiking on vegetation like seaweed. However, unlike plastics, that organic matter breaks down quickly.
As we marked Earth Day on April 22nd, millions of people around the world rolled up their sleeves to clean up beaches, plant gardens, or commit to living more sustainably to avoid the catastrophic effects of climate change.
While the most crucial thing humans can do is to stop burning fossil fuels, a growing number of methods, from planting trees to carbon capture, are attempting to remove the tons of greenhouse gases already pumped into the atmosphere.
The ocean has a natural ability to absorb huge amounts of carbon, and that's inspired a technology called Sea Change, developed by researchers at UCLA. It can rinse CO2 from seawater and return less acidic water to the ocean, where it can absorb more greenhouse gases.
At a barge docked at the Port of Los Angeles, seawater is zapped with an electrical charge which kicks off a series of chemical reactions that convert the CO2 into solids like limestone and magnesite, the stuff of seashells.
Cleaned water is then returned to the ocean and ready to take up more CO2, and the shell minerals are sent to the seafloor or possibly used to replenish beach sand or made into building materials like cement.
And a byproduct of the process is hydrogen, a clean fuel being used in transportation. The researchers also say a filtration system prevents marine life from being sucked into the system.
Sounds good, but this project won't capture anywhere near the amount of carbon we need to grab, as over 37 billion tons are dumped into the atmosphere each year. But they say roughly 1,800 plants could sequester about 10 billion tons annually and make a dent.
Another demonstration site is starting this month in Singapore.
And finally, hiking through a desert might give the impression of a mostly barren space with just patches of shrubs, but the craggy surface beneath your shoes is actually a living skin called biocrust, and it's teeming with life, performing remarkable feats.
Biocrusts contain algae, fungi, lichens, and mosses that sequester carbon, stabilize soils, retain water, and fix nitrogen for plants. That is, unless it's trampled, driven across, and built upon, which is increasingly the case around the globe.
Biocrusts are also threatened by climate change. So what to do to restore these vital ecosystems? Enter crustavoltaics, a newly coined term by researchers at Arizona State University who rejuvenated biocrusts by covering them with solar panels.
During a 3-year study in the Sonoran Desert, the team found that photovoltaic panels created a greenhouse-like microclimate that promoted biocrust formation, doubling its biomass when compared with uncovered areas.
In short, crustavoltaics are a biocrust nursery which can be used to replenish arid lands that have been damaged or destroyed. The team says the technique requires fewer resources than other methods and has the added benefit of producing renewable energy as it stores carbon and builds biodiversity.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
Just wanted to thank Joel for the program today, Connections, April 21st, Friday. Joel, been your student since 1982, and you're still laying it down after 40 years. Love it. The issues today, for those who didn't hear it, going into lack of any objectivity in media and academia as far as Palestine, making sure that there is some coverage. And thank you, KGNU, for supporting this to happen. And then also just how we fund universities. And I was a student at GSIS, and as it turned to Corbell School, and fighting the funding from Piedmont Mines at that point as well. It's an important issue to go further into so that we maintain academic freedom. So, Joel, just thank you for laying it down for us as usual and putting some of us, I'm probably going on too long, in check for speaking too long. So I appreciate that too. Have a good one.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Steve Miller, Alyssa Palazzo, Alexis Kenyon, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, and in-studio guest Lee Campbell-Hale for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's going to be coming up just on the other side of the headlines from the BBC. But first, we're going to play some promos.